From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, street scenes from our archives. Screenwriter and novelist Richard Price talks about hanging out with crack dealers and cops while researching his best-selling novel, Clockers. It's just come out in paperback. Price also wrote the screenplays for The Color of Money, Sea of Love, and Mad Dog and Glory. Also today, trying to keep gang members away from trouble. We hear from Jim Gallopo. He's a Los Angeles probation officer who's worked with gang members since the aftermath of the Watts riots. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Nirvana's new album, In Utero. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Senator Bob Packwood of Oregon is considering resigning, according to his lawyer. Attorney James Fitzpatrick said this evening that while Packwood has not yet resigned, all options are open, and he added he didn't know when Packwood would make a final decision. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
Rumors swirled around the Senate all day that Packwood's resignation was imminent. According to some Senate sources, the senator did draft a letter of resignation, but was persuaded by the GOP leadership to wait to submit it until after the Senate recesses for the Thanksgiving holiday, when most senators will have left town. Meanwhile, the Senate Ethics Committee met on and off throughout the day. For months, Packwood has been under investigation for alleged sexual misconduct and intimidation of witnesses. It could not be learned immediately if today's Ethics Committee meetings involved that investigation or possibly a decision to open further formal inquiries into allegations of influence peddling that were raised by entries in Packwood's diaries. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
The union representing pilots at American Airlines said today that it will not join flight attendants in their strike. The president of the pilots' union said that pilots will not take part in a sympathy strike because the flight attendants have been so successful in crippling the airline by themselves. The pilots' union had asked its members to vote on whether to go out in sympathy, but the union president said the votes won't be counted. The airline filed suit against the striking flight attendants today, charging that the union has been conducting what it called a malicious, defamatory campaign to convince potential travelers that American is unsafe during the strike. The company's asking for $10 million in damages. The union says it never made any such statement. On the second day of the strike, passengers have been stranded around the country on the Friday before the biggest travel holiday of the year. Doug McPherson of member station WBUR reports on the effect on passengers in Boston.
Outside Boston's Logan Airport this afternoon, about three dozen flight attendants walked the picket line. Inside, about the same number of passengers waited in hopes their flights would be called. Officials at the company's Dallas headquarters refused to say how many scheduled flights actually departed from Boston today, but passengers and ticket agents agreed it was no more than a handful. Amanda Matalin of Coral Gables, Florida, described herself as a homesick college freshman who hoped to board a flight to Miami.
Nobody called me. They told me to call early this afternoon. The lines have been busy. Nobody has gotten in touch with me, so I'm in the dark. I don't know what's going on.
Some passengers whose flight did appear to be on schedule to depart said they were uncertain if they would board the flight out of fear they would be unable to secure their return flight home. For National Public Radio, I'm Doug McPherson in Boston.
The Dow Industrials gained 9 points today to close at 3,694. This is NPR. President Clinton met today in Seattle with Chinese President Jiang Zemin and said the two leaders pledged to build a positive relationship. The president said the talks failed to resolve their differences over human rights and proliferation of weapons technology. A face-to-face encounter between two of the most important figures in the mafia world has taken place in a Rome courtroom. As Francis Kennedy reports, the two men, once allies, are now enemies.
The alleged head of the Sicilian mafia, Totò Riina, had asked for a meeting with his main accuser, Tommaso Buscetta. But when it came, he refused to speak, saying Buscetta was immoral because he'd had three wives. Buscetta, his face obscured for security reasons, told the court that Riina had approved or ordered every single murder that had taken place in Palermo province. Riina, who since his arrest has denied any wrongdoing, appeared nervous as Buscetta bombarded him with accusations. The two were rivals in the Great Mafia War, which was won by Reina's Corleonesi clan. When Buscetta decided to turn state witness, Reina allegedly ordered the murder of more than 30 members of his family. For National Public Radio, I'm Frances Kennedy in Rome.
Republican campaign strategist Ed Rollins reportedly told Democratic Party lawyers today that he lied when he said the campaign paid to suppress the black vote in New Jersey's gubernatorial race. A lawyer for the New Jersey Republican Committee quoted Rollins as testifying, "I lied from top to bottom." Rollins set off an uproar when he claimed that Republicans used so-called walking around money to suppress votes that might have gone to Democratic incumbent Jim Florio. He told reporters that black New Jersey ministers were offered contributions to their favorite charities if they'd refrain from urging their congregations to vote. Rollins promptly recanted those remarks. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I wasn't surprised when writer Richard Price first teamed up with Martin Scorsese because they both tell stories about the kind of streetwise, ethnic characters they grew up with. Price wrote the screenplay for Scorsese's The Color of Money and Scorsese's segment of New York Stories. Now Scorsese will produce the movie adaptation of Price's best-selling novel, Clockers, which has just come out in paperback. Clockers is about crack dealers and cops. Half the chapters are told from the cop's point of view, the other half from the dealer's. Price had written from a cop's perspective before in his screenplays for Sea of Love, which starred Al Pacino, and Mad Dog and Glory, which starred Robert De Niro and Bill Murray. Our interview was recorded in the summer of 92 when Clockers was first published. Before we talked, Richard Price read from Clockers. I let him set up the story.
One of the main characters in a book is this kid Strike, who's a 19-year-old drug dealer, who's a sub-lieutenant for this other guy who's an older, more charismatic figure in the community. He's a drug dealer that has Strike and a dozen kids working for him. And his name is Rodney. And what Rodney likes to do is he likes to take five of his young drug dealers for sort of a booster club, Chamber of Commerce-type lunch, where he lectures them on having the right attitude. And the kids never really get what Rodney's saying because they're too young and too immature in their life is, you know, too scattered and impulsive. And Strike is the only guy that Rodney's ever gotten through to, and Strike has become sort of his de facto son and his young prince. And at this point, Rodney has been lecturing the kids for about 15 minutes about bank books and prudence and everything, and the kids are all spacing out on him. And this is Strike's thoughts about what Rodney has just put forth to all the other drug dealers. Strike guessed that he was probably the only kid who had ever received Rodney's restaurant lecture and understood right away what he was saying. During that first lunch a year ago, Rodney's eyes had lit up with gratitude and pride when he saw Strike stay right with him. Finally, he'd saved one. Rodney's other clockers always went down. They were too poor, too immature, a lifetime of one way going up against 2 months of the other way. Other way didn't stand a chance. You got to start respecting yourself. Rodney was still hammering away, not ready to give up. The kid that spends it as fast as he makes it don't believe it's real, don't believe in himself. He's thinking like with a 2-minute clock, thinking like a poor man, like his life is day to day, minute to minute. He got no future because he don't think of no future. Strike watched the kids tune out, dip in fries and ketchup, one by one turning to wave down the waitress and order orange sodas or Cokes, their cognacs left unfinished. You got to believe in yourself. You got to start thinking about your future. And that means you got to start saving your damn money. Hell, they do, Rodney pointed out to the room. There ain't a person in this restaurant right now can't go home and show me a bank book. And you kids making more day by day, week by week than them all. But I'll bet come the end of the month they got more than you do. Rodney whirled his hands around each other, cocking his head. Do you all get what I'm saying? I hear that, Charles said automatically. Rodney sagged with frustration, looking like the old man of 37 he was, then said, well, the hell with it, I tried, and got back to his ribs. Strike was relieved that the lecture seemed to be over, glad that Rodney didn't do his self-image exercise, making everybody come up with a positive word that started with the same letter as their first name. Going around the table, people saying stuff like terrific Tyrone, sexy Strike, rockin' Rodney. 6 months ago, one kid had called himself Brightful Booker, and then almost put his fork in someone's chest when everybody laughed. But Rodney wasn't done. He lit up again, tried one last approach. I mean, look at Strike here. The kids did as they were told, Strike looking away as if he had seen something out at the bar. Look how my man dressed. No flash, color coordinated, nice pair of dark Reeboks, none of them paratrooper sneakers you all like to wear. Jump out a window, you bounce right back. No one laughed. I mean, check this out. The narcotics roll up on my man at a red light. What do they see? Because you know they're going to be profiling. They see a kid in a 2-year-old Accord, no gold on, nice hair, not no high-rise billboard up top his head, nice dark sweater, probably driving like my grandma. You think the narcotics going to be thinking clocker? Hell no, they thinking a 9-to-5 kid working at First Jersey or some damn thing. Strike's doing it right. Strike's getting over, cause Strike's quiet storm. Strike fumed, thinking lose the Accord. A table of strangers now knowing it's a dope car. And Strike's got himself a safe. Abruptly, Strike rose from his chair. Now they all knew he saved it, which meant he's got it. Rodney getting him killed. Strike stood over Rodney, trying to hold in his anger, keep himself stone-faced and without stammering. I got to book. I got to see my parole officer. As Strike walked from the table, he heard Rodney say, Strike's got like 4 safes. So come knock night, when the narcos come down, they can't confiscate his money. See what I'm saying? I mean, Strike's here to stay. Strike palmed his gut. Lose the safes. Lose the Accord. Lose Rodney, too.
Richard Price, how did you start observing this scene?
Well, in 1986, I was going out with cops in Hudson County, New Jersey, sort of soaking up some atmosphere for Sea of Love. And I got very hooked on seeing the world through cops' eyes, because when you run with cops, you see, you know, humans in such extremis. You get, you never see life on such a life and death level, day in, day out, night times, day times. It wasn't that I was crazy about cops, but I just wanted to keep witnessing, you know, all this human struggle. And at some point, I decided that I would like to leave the cops' point of view and see the world through the eyes of those that the cops deal with, which are the world of the victims, the world of the predators, and all the people for which the cop in the neighborhood coming down very quickly is more prevalent than the mailman coming.
But how did you get connected to the dealers? It's easier to call up a precinct and ask for permission to drive around with cops.
The cops called the dealers for me. It's, you know, in a mid-sized city, the way law and order works, it's real flexible. I mean, everybody needs everybody. A homicide investigator won't solve any crimes if he doesn't have people talking to him. And if you don't do favors for people, people won't do favors for you. And everything is relative. So, yeah, you skipped your hearing and there's a warrant out on you and a cop says, well, I'll fix it for you, but remember my name. And, you know, the guy's going to have to remember his name. Or, you know, the criminal's got a problem, and he'll come to the cop and say, listen, if you can get me out from under the rock, I'll give you a name on something else which is heavier, or I'll turn over the guys that I've been dealing with buying from in greater quantity. It's all little fish giving up bigger fish.
So when you first approached dealers and told them that you were writing a book and you wanted to follow them for a while, what kind of rap did you give them?
Well, I just met them through the cops. I met them in the homicide office, this one guy, and you know, we just talk for you. People just check you out, and basically they want to see, A, if hanging out with you is going to put them in jeopardy, B, are you a jerk? I certainly wasn't going to put anybody in jeopardy for helping me out, and I guess I wasn't big enough jerk for them to say no. And, after a 3-hour conversation, the dealer in front of the cop said, well, you ought to walk a mile in my shoes. Why don't you come on out with me tomorrow night? I looked at the cop, and he said, sure, why not?
What were the rules you had to follow when you were traveling or hanging out with dealers?
There were no rules. It wasn't like, now I'm going to take you to a place, you know, don't look anybody in the eye. It was none of that stuff. I was with, the baddest guy in town. So it's, you know, it was like, where does a 500-pound gorilla sit anywhere he wants? I'm with him, you know. I'm with Gorgo over here. So, you know, just, you know, don't lose sight of him. You know, don't let him wander off and, you know, leave you alone. I mean, I wouldn't be in that place for a nanosecond without a guy like that.
How would he explain you to other people?
Just say, I'm this writer. You know, I got this writer coming around and, you know, they'd look at him and, you know, everybody got used to seeing me because I was, you know, and, so, you know, at some times I would be like the only white guy around And, you know, if they see a white guy walking around in circles like that who's not obviously a customer, the second thought is that the guy's a cop. You know, so this guy Rodney, the Rodney character, you know, basically had to constantly calm people down and explain to them that, you know, I'm not there, that my presence is not a danger to them, and I should be allowed to live.
Richard Price is my guest. His new novel is called Clockers, and it's about dealers and cops. And he's also a screenwriter in addition to a novelist, and his movies include Sea of Love, the Martin Scorsese episode of New York Stories, and The Color of Money. I'm going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Screenwriter and novelist Richard Price is my guest. Now, you hung out with cops a lot as part of your research, too.
Right.
And I'm wondering if the cops, knowing that you were also hanging out with dealers, ever tried to get information from you.
Oh, well, the funny thing is that I hung out with everybody so much, people kind of forgot that I was a writer, and they started telling me more than they were telling the guy that sent me to him in the first place. I mean, they were, you know, occupationally adversaries. So he would say, to the cop who sent me over, hey, man, don't tell him this. But, you know, he thinks I'm over here, but I'm really over there, you know. And then I'd run with the cop, and he'd say, well, you know, don't tell Rodney this. But, you know, he thinks I'm over here, but I'm really over there. So in a way, I knew more than, I mean, I was like the girlfriend between this married couple. And it was kind of like a marriage between these cops and these dope dealers. Because, as I said, they needed each other. Every once in a while, somebody would pull a real number on me. Like, I was, you know, my standard fee was like $100 for a sit-down. If you sit down and answer my questions for $3, I'll buy you some drinks and I'll buy you a steak, and you get $100 change. And I sat down with this narcotics cop, and he talked for about 2 hours, and I gave him $100, and he took the money, but he didn't say thank you, and he gave me kind of like a dirty look, which I couldn't figure out. I was a little paranoid. And the next night, I went out with one of the drug dealers, and I spent, a number of hours with him, at the end of which he got his pay, and he started laughing. And I said, what's so funny? He says, yeah. He says, you gave Frank $100 last night, didn't you? He says, yeah, last time I had a meet with Frank, I told him you were paying me $500. You know? So, things like that would happen. But that's what I mean. There was like an intimacy there that, that at its base is potentially deadly and deceptively relaxed. But it's not, you there, drop that gun. I mean, it's real flexible out there. There's not too many oak trees. There's lots of willows.
Did you get the impression that the cops respected the dealers and the dealers respected the cops on some level?
No, it's respect is a funny word. Understood is a better word. I mean, mm-hmm. People understood why people did the way. It's really, unless you're brain dead, if you're a cop and you're out there a certain number of years, you have to have some getting of wisdom about why people are the way they are and how people act in certain situations. I don't think there's a cop in the world who doesn't, deep down inside, understand how a kid can, at 15 or 16, turn into a drug dealer, given what he's seen since that kid had been born in that neighborhood. You know, and there's probably, the more reflective cops always wind up saying, there but for the grace of God go I. If I had been born in this project, I don't know. I probably wouldn't be a cop. I'd probably be like him.
One of your cops in the novel says he's done so many strip searches over the years that there's one guy's underwear who he is more familiar with than his own. What's the etiquette for you when you're standing by watching a strip search?
I don't help. I mean, I just stand there back discreetly, and the kids were going crazy because they couldn't figure out who I was. This sixth white guy in this car that used to come down and make their lives miserable at any time of night or day. And they knew those five guys. They christened them. They gave them their street names. And so when there's a sixth guy that they don't know, they get all hinky because they say, who the hell is this guy? Is this a new guy we have to worry about? Well, he doesn't look like a cop. He's kind of skinny. He looks a little scared. He doesn't have a gun. Do you think maybe he's a special cop? Or maybe he's a commissioner? Or maybe, he's a lawyer? But they were going crazy trying to figure out who I was. And I don't want to make eye contact with anybody because then they're going to see, you know how much I'm really holding it in. And until I finally heard one guy say really out loud, "That guy ain't no cop, man. Look how scared he is." Of course, Richard, you completely fall apart when they say that. But
cops and dealers tend to have their own language. And I wonder if that's one of the things that interests you as a writer.
Oh, sure. You know, I've always been into you know, the way the urban patois, you know, of any group. What I decided to do is that some of these kids were, it sounded like Lord Buckley to me, or somebody you have to listen 10 times before you understand what they're saying. But by and large, I decided to forego, you know, doing the Margaret Mead number and getting the glossary right, because I figured even if I nailed it, you know, by the time it hits the book, it's old news. You know, so I just decided to concentrate on good dialogue, which is to say dialogue which, because of the progression of the words, captures the way that individual metabolizes his thoughts.
Is clockers a word you made up yourself?
No, clockers is a word I heard from a kid in the Bronx and I heard from another kid in Jersey City, but I didn't hear it that often. It basically means the kids get addicted to selling as much as other people get addicted to smoking it. The transaction of bottles for cash is an addicting ritual. And I had kids tell me about how they developed constipation problems because they got so hung up on the money they were making down there. They were holding it in. They didn't want to go upstairs and sit on the toilet and miss all that money. It was an addiction, and they were clocking, which is to say they were there around the clock.
I think the first novel that you wrote was The Wanderers. That was your first, right?
Right.
And that was about gangs in the Bronx, in the neighborhood that you grew up. Do you think there's a connection between your interest in writing about gangs when you were younger and writing now about people who are on the streets selling drugs?
Well, yeah, because I feel like the only... wherever you are in life, you're always only from one place. And for me, that's the Housing Project's working class background in the Bronx. And the projects have changed so dramatically, other than, you know, the bricks are the same, but that's about it, that in a way I felt like I was going home and starting all over again as a writer after this 8-year hiatus as a screenwriter. And I'm trying to find myself again as a writer, and it's almost like going home. But, you know, home has changed. It's like Rip Van Winkle.
Well, have you literally gone home back to the housing project you grew up in? And
yeah,
so,
I've been around there. And no, actually, it's ethnically it's changed. It's no longer as racially mixed as it was. I think it's still a pretty good project. I mean, it looks well kept. And, I know the cops from that precinct, and I know that that's one of the, you know, more benign precincts in the city.
I know you spent some time teaching at Daytop, which is a drug rehabilitation center.
Right.
You were teaching writing, reading?
Well, I was volunteer teaching creative writing. I was, I had my own drug problem in the early 80s, and sort of when I cleaned myself up, I decided that I should take it a step further, and I went to Daytop to, just talk to the kids that were trying to deal with drugs that was so much more potent and pernicious than the stuff that I fell down on at a such more vulnerable age and with such more hideous backgrounds than I had. I just sort of felt like, let me go in there and tell them, listen, I have it a lot easier than you in this world, you know, and I couldn't handle, you know, 3-cut party coke, and you guys are doing kryptonite, you know. I couldn't handle it. You know, and I'm here to tell you that. And then, you know, from there, I just say, you know, it's sort of like going into an AA meeting and saying, hi, you know, my name is Bob, I'm an alcoholic, you know. I mean, it's like I'm, you know, I was in no better shape than any of them. And then, you know, from there, we'd go on and do writing exercises, try to get them to do some experiential writing and express themselves.
Did you like that? Did you like teaching there?
Yeah, I did, because it's not the usual. The thing is, I actually probably enjoy teaching adults and, you know, people in circumstances, educational circumstances like that, much better than I do teaching in a regular, American university, because it's so much more of a struggle for that kid or for that adult to be present in that classroom. It's much more of a conscious choice. It's not that, well, I'm 19 now and I'm supposed to be here, so I'm here. I mean, there's a hunger present in the classroom that I find, much more electrifying.
I think you're probably in the process now of turning your novel Clockers into a screenplay, or has that been done already?
Well, I'm taking a shot at it.
So you're still working on it?
Oh yeah, mm-hmm. It's the never-ending story.
So where do you start? You wrote the novel first. Now you're turning it into a screenplay.
What you do, the first thing you do with a book when you make it into a script is throw it out the window. It's what I did on Color of Money. Unfortunately, the book is mine, and I know every line by heart.
Mm-hmm.
And, you're supposed to obviously kill your darlings, but I thought I killed all my darlings, and I still have a 300-page script. It's like Lonesome Dove. so I have a lot of work to do and a lot of rethinking. It's very hard. I mean, what a screenwriter does is reinvent a novel for a different art form. He really doesn't know anything to the novel except to capture the spirit of what the book was about. And what you have to do is you have to take 100 pages of deathless prose and just dump it and think about two or three scenes in 10 pages that will, visually and for that medium in shorthand tell you what those 100 pages he threw out the window told you. And it's very tough to reinvent your own book when you've got it so deeply entrenched in you. I've never done this before. I feel like a cannibal eating his own foot.
Do you think you're making a mistake in trying to do it yourself?
Oh, yeah. But, it's my mistake to make. I mean, there's nothing. Listen, whoever is going to do this book is going to screw it up, and they're going to get paid for it. I'd rather screw up my own book, thank you. I mean, I'd rather, I'm saying this, semi-facetiously. I mean, obviously, I hope to make this work. But, I mean, it's the most frustrating thing in the world is that you write a book and you feel proud of it and it has a certain vision. And then when they make a movie out of it, some guy just goes in there hacking away merrily in his butcher's apron, and you go nuts when you see the finished product on the screen. If this thing doesn't work, I'd much rather be the one that's responsible for its failure than some other screenwriter, because it's the lesser of two pains.
This is the first novel of yours that doesn't come out of your life. All the others were in some way autobiographical.
Right.
Was it movies that got you out of yourself in terms of the subject of your writing?
Well, what happened is that, like with the breaks, I kind of felt bankrupt as an autobiographical writer. I started to feel like I went to the well too many times. And I decided that a solution out of that would be I had all these offers to do screenplays. And I decided, well, you tell me a story and I'll write it. I can't come up with any great epiphanic structures right now. I'm a pen for hire. Whose body do you want me to inhabit? You want me to be a pool hustler? Okay, no problem. You want to be a cop? Okay, I'll be an abstract artist. I'll be, like the Headless Horseman. You just keep them checks coming. And, I'll just sort of refresh myself. I always knew that I would be coming back to writing novels. I do believe that sometimes there are second acts in American lives. And I did. It took a lot longer than I thought it would take for me to get back to novels because... unlike cocaine, screenwriting is impossible to give up. And when you get good at it, the seduction is potent. It's constantly, you can work with this big star that you never worked with before and get this big check. You've never seen numbers like this before. And you're constantly, it's like they're throwing all this candy at you and you want to say, no, I'm going to go home and eat, my whole wheat toast. I'm going to do my novel because it's good for me and I've got to grow as a person. But, the fact of the matter is that you do. And at some point, I just had enough.
How does it feel to have written a novel again?
It feels great. I mean, I've never been so proud of anything I've ever written.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
No, you're welcome.
Richard Price's novel Clockers has just come out in paperback. Price is writing the screenplay for the film adaptation of Clockers. Spike Lee will direct it. Our interview was recorded last year when Clockers was first published. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, a former juvenile delinquent who now tries to keep gang members out of trouble. We feature an interview from our archives with Jim Gallopo, a probation officer who works with gang members in South Central L.A. He's been at it for over 27 years. He's worked with the Crips and the Bloods since they were organized. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Nirvana's new album, In Utero. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Union leaders for pilots at American Airlines say the pilots will not join a flight attendant strike. Earlier this week, the Allied Pilots Association had asked its members to vote on whether to stage a sympathy walkout. But the union president said late this afternoon that the board had decided not to count the votes because the flight attendants have been so successful at crippling the airline. This announcement came on a second day of a walkout that has moved thousands of passengers to other flights or left them stranded. Republican political consultant Ed Rollins spent the day testifying under oath about his role in the New Jersey governor's election. Rollins gave a deposition about his statements that the GOP made payoffs to suppress black voting. Republican officials present today say that Rollins once again retracted his remarks. Steve Inskeep of member station WBGO reports.
Ed Rollins says, "I lied. I lied from top to bottom. It was BS. I was playing head games with my rival Democratic consultant, James Carville." That's according to an attorney for the Republican State Committee of New Jersey, the first lawyer to emerge from 8 hours of testimony by the Republican consultant. Soon we hope to have transcripts confirming just how Rollins testified under oath about his statements the GOP made payoffs to suppress the black vote in the New Jersey election. Republicans say it's now time to move on. Democrats have said the scandal may not end just because the suspects deny wrongdoing. For National Public Radio, I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington.
The Senate Armed Services Committee has held its first hearing on the nomination of Morton Halperin to the newly created position of Assistant Secretary of Defense for Democracy and Peacemaking. And he used the opportunity to refute charges that conservatives have been making against him. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Halperin worked in the Pentagon in the 1960s and on the National Security Council staff in the Nixon White House until he resigned over Vietnam. He has also served as director of the Washington office of the ACLU and has been a prolific contributor to foreign policy journals. Republican opponents accuse Halperin of being a Soviet apologist and opposing all covert intelligence operations. Halperin says those charges are false.
"And I stand by all of my recent writings and statements. If the charge against me is espousing pointed and provocative views, I have no quarrel with that description. But I resist any suggestion that I have done anything which compromises our nation's security or weakens our defenses."
The Armed Services Committee continues its hearings on Halperin next week. This is Brian Naylor at the Capitol.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 8.5 points to close at 3,694.01. on volume of 301 million shares. Declining issues led advances in heavy trading. This is NPR News. In Somalia, a group of factional leaders opposed to General Adid say that they will meet with him if his supporters lay down their arms. A dozen factions also demanded that Adid's forces return stolen property and that he recognize UN-supported district and regional governing councils before entering talks on a political settlement. Adid has boycotted UN efforts to set up councils as a first step toward restoring a national government. Instead, he has set up his own councils in areas under his control. In Ohio, it's day two of a controversy involving the Ku Klux Klan, an official state Christmas tree, and a menorah. Bill Cohen of Ohio Public Radio reports.
Yesterday, the agency in charge of the Capitol grounds ruled the traditional holiday tree and a giant Hanukkah menorah would be barred from the state house. The reason? Officials wanted to make sure the Ku Klux Klan didn't win the right to erect their own giant cross at the Capitol. Within hours, operators at the governor's office saw their switchboards light up like Christmas trees.
Governor's office? Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Oh, you think it's terrible. Well, we do also. Yes, I agree with you, and you think that if we keep on, we'll be eliminating Christianity and everything else.
Today, the governor and legislative leaders basically told State House grounds managers, reverse your ruling. That's what's expected to happen Tuesday. For National Public Radio, this is Bill Cohen in Columbus.
Secretary of State Warren Christopher says that the U.S. will not make changes in the so-called Blair House Agreement on farm trade. Speaking today in Seattle, Christopher said that the farm agreement was worked out in good faith and that officials must proceed on that basis. The agreement worked out between the U.S. and members of the European Community calls for cuts in subsidies to EC farm exports. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. My guest, Jim Gallopo, knows a lot about gangs. He's worked with L.A. gang members for close to 28 years, since the aftermath of the Watts riots. Gallopo is a probation officer with the Los Angeles County Metropolitan Specialized Gang Unit. He works on the streets with gang members who are on probation. Some of the conditions of probation are difficult to enforce, such as the restriction against associating with known gang members. Gallopo says he concentrates on keeping his people away from guns, drugs, and trouble. Gallopo is a physically imposing man. He's 6'1", 230 pounds, and has a shaved head. When I spoke with him last March, he told me his job has become more dangerous as gangs have gotten deeper into drugs and guns.
The nature of the gang has changed a lot over the last 25 years or so since the gang started. And basically, in the black gangs, it used to be what we call going from the shoulders, where guys would fight basically one-on-one. There could be 50 gang members from each gang there, but the two guys would go at it, and maybe a few other side fights would break out. But, you know, it was one-on-one, basically, and when one guy beat the other guy, in essence, into submission, then, you know, that was over. And there was no disrespect, you know, to lose to a guy who was that much tougher than you. Nowadays, these guys don't do that. They don't have what we call the heart anymore they used to have. And they'll go by 40 miles an hour in a van and shoot a shotgun. You know, by the time they hit somebody, they don't even know who they hit. By the time the person hits the ground, they're three blocks down the street. So there's a lot, it's a lot less personal. There's a lot less courage. There's a lot less discipline or honor involved. And what attracted me to the gangs initially was the fact that there was a lot of honor involved. They had a code and they lived by it. Today, it's just not that way. I mean, you know, you never could used to be able to get a gang member to what you call snitch or to roll over, you know, on another gang member. Now, I mean, it's just commonplace that they will do that.
What's the age range of the people who you see? The people who are,
my youngest probationer is normally around 15 years old, which I have very few of. My oldest is in their late 30s, which I have very few of. The majority of them are between 17 and 20 years old.
The ones who are 15, are they sometimes more difficult to deal with because they're young and inexperienced?
Certainly.
What makes them more difficult? In what ways are they more difficult?
They are normally involved in an activity we call making their bones, which is trying to, you know, to gain status in the gang. And so they will do any crazy thing to try to bring themselves up in the eyes of the more high-status gang members, like drive-bys or walk-in liquor store robberies and bank robberies and all kinds of things that they'll do to try to gain status in the gang. Shoot at a police car from an apartment or a house or, you know, a corner, you know, just things that would bring them status.
How effective do you think prison is in punishing or reforming gang members?
Well, I think it's very effective in punishing, but I just see little or no evidence that there's any rehabilitation or reformation going on. I mean, you know, sometimes a guy will burn out. He'll get old enough in prison, he'll been there long enough and just say, I don't want to come back to this mess. This is a zoo, it's crazy, and you know, no matter what I got to do, I'm not coming back here. And, you know, but the prison system in California is, you know, I understand from colleagues around the country, everywhere else, is just a revolving door. And you know, people a lot of times feel safer because a guy gets, you know, 8 years in the penitentiary for some heinous crime. And, you know, the guy's going to do three, you know, and get paroled, or four and get paroled. He's back. And when they come back, they're worse than when they went in too many cases. You know, they're buffed up physically. They're stronger from lifting weights and eating well and going, you know, getting sleep and rest and exercise and all this. And mentally, they're just, you know, one of the guys who described it great to me, when you're in the joint, you got to act crazy, you know, to survive. And, you know, once you act crazy and learn the crazy way of life, again, there's a Hispanic slogan called La Vida Loca. And that is, you know, crazy life. And, you know, they learn to act crazy, be crazy, and they come back out. It's hard to get through with that.
My guest is Jim Gallipo, a probation officer with the Los Angeles County Metropolitan Specialized Gang Unit. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is L.A. probation officer Jim Gallipo. Now, you were telling us that there was more of a code when you were younger, you know, when you started working this job, and that's part of what interested you in the gangs, and
yeah.
That code doesn't really exist anymore. So what keeps you on the job?
I don't know. I'm old. You know, I've developed a relationship with gang members who are, some of them now are almost 40 years old, who are the original Crips and Bloods, they're like a family to me. I have, you know, I'm in a unique situation, particularly being a Caucasian, I care about them, and they care about me, and we've had a long life together, and most of them should not have lived to be as old as they are by, you know, statistical inference. And their retort to me is, you certainly shouldn't have lived to be as old as you are, being down here as long as you've been. And, you know, it's true.
You're saying you're close with a lot of the original gang members.
That's right. OGs.
Yeah. Now, so is there often a turning point in a relationship that you have with a gang member where you go from being the authority figure that they do not want to deal with to someone who they trust and feel more close to?
Yeah. Every gang member that makes it with me reaches that point.
What do you mean by making it? Like they make it through probation?
They either make it to that point, or they're dead, or they're incarcerated for long periods of time. And, you know, when they come out, even some of them have come back and said, man, I wish I had listened then. You know, I'd like to work with you. I'd like to try to help you, because these youngsters, no matter how much they respect me as a probation officer, I'm still the man, you know, and these guys are the guys that they look to like the second coming of Christ. You know, I mean, these are the guys they listen to. These are the guys they admire. These are the guys they want to be like. And when these guys can turn around and come back and say, let me tell you what it was like being in San Quentin or in Folsom, or here's what it was like when I got sentenced to the joint, and my wife came up with my kids and was saying goodbye to me at county jail before I went to the joint, and I saw, a guard or somebody pinch her on the ass or disrespect her, and I'm sitting behind, a cage and all this type of thing. And then, you know, they go into the homosexual pressure and the gang pressure and, you know, the physical violence in the penitentiary. And, you know, these guys, nobody can do it like these guys can, you know. And they tell them, you don't want to do this. You know, you do not want to have to live the life I did. And let me show you how you can still have heart and not do that.
Now, you were in gangs when you were young, right?
Well, they weren't the same kind of gangs. When I was young, they were basically car clubs and that acted like the early Crips and the black gangs prior to the Crips and Bloods.
Were you ever in prison?
No.
Juvenile hall?
No.
Okay.
Jail, yes.
You were in jail, okay.
Yeah, I was in jail a number of times, but I never quite made it. I had an existential experience with a police officer and a probation officer that ultimately changed my life around when I was young.
With a probation officer?
Yeah, a probation officer and a juvenile police officer in Long Beach.
What happened, and did that affect you becoming a probation officer yourself? Maybe.
I guess it did.
So what happened?
Not consciously. Uh-huh. Well, I was a real delinquent when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. I was into stealing cars and fighting and breaking into liquor store warehouses and did commercial burglaries on music stores and. I was just a fast kid. My mother had multiple sclerosis and was dying since my birth. And my father was a milling machinist first at the Naval Shipyard in Long Beach and ultimately at Douglas Aircraft. And he worked a swing shift so he could, take care of my mother. And he'd get about 3 hours sleep, and then he'd have to get up, and he would get up and wake me up and cook me breakfast so he could be with me. That's the only time we got to see each other. So I basically was on my own to do, he'd go out, go to work, and I'd sneak out of his car. go pick up my homeboys, pick up girls, go do all this kind of stuff, drinking, using marijuana, all this stuff when I was real young. And I got arrested a lot. So ultimately, one time I came to jail as usual, and they called my father at Douglas, and he'd have to, after he got off work, he'd have to take a bus home, get in his car, and come down and get me out, which would usually be, 2 o'clock in the morning or so. And, the cops and the probation officer was there at the time. They were talking, telling me what a punk I was and a little asshole and all that. And I'm telling them, F you. And we're going to send you up. And I'm saying, get down and do what I ain't afraid of your jail. I kind of look forward to going to camp because, then there was a badge of honor. And I thought it might be a nice experience, So here comes my father, who had never smoked, never drank, never womanized. All his whole social life was taking care of me and my mother. And they would go for rides when he didn't work. They'd go for rides in the car. And that was his whole total existence. I was smart enough to realize at that time that I couldn't take care of my mother. And without him. And the only prayer, I was raised Catholic, and the only prayer I ever said was, please, God, don't let this man die, until I'm old enough that I could take care of my mother. And so here he came, and I'd never seen the man cry. He was quiet, gentle. He was a man of extreme, honor. And they tell him, Mr. Gallipo, we're going to have to take your son away from you. He's just, you can't control him. I know you've tried everything. We know your wife is sick, but we're going to have to put him someplace where, because he's just too wild and all this. And all, and I looked around at my father and winked and said, hey, f*** them, excuse me. They ain't nothing. They can't hurt me. They put me in their camp. I'll be back out, no problem. And I looked at him, and he started crying. He just broke down physically and started sobbing. And I'd never seen this man. This man had been, without me knowing it, the strongest man I'd ever known. And to this date, he probably is. And I just, I looked at him and realized I had done this to him. And he just broke down and started sobbing, telling him, look, I'll get another job, too. I'll put him in a private school. I'll work all day and night to pay for it. Don't take him away. It'll kill his mother. It will kill his mother to put him, away. Please don't do that. I'll do anything. I'll do anything. And all of a sudden, I realized the prayer I'm praying to God, I am executing. I am killing this man. I am killing this man, and he's doing this kind of thing for me and my mother, and I'm out there killing him. So I just, then I turned around to them and said, hey, give me a chance, and they, you ain't nothing, and you ain't shit, and you don't deserve to have a father like that. And I said, look, just give me one chance. Give me one chance. I'm not afraid to go to your jail, that, but please, I can't do this to them. I said, you give me a chance, and they did. They gave me 6 months to, you know, to straighten out my act. And you know, I went to my little gang meeting and told everybody, at, you know, that I was out, you know, that I loved them and that I loved the streets and the stuff we were doing. But that I just had to, you know, I explained the situation exactly as it occurred. And, I mean, some of those guys cried, you know. And one guy came out with me. When I walked out of the meeting, he came out and said, hey, you know, my mother's a nurse, man. She's taking care of me and my sister alone, and I'm doing the same thing to her.
Jim, one last question. Do you ever tell the story to the gang members that you're working with?
It's hard for me, but I do. I do it, you know, when I have a case that I think really needs, you know, something, because it's still emotional. My father's been dead now for four or five years, but, you know, it's just, it is something very emotional for me to say, you know, to discuss this. And I do it, you know, it's painful for me to think back to what I had done, you know, to this man for so many years and all that. And, you know, so I don't do it frequently, but I do it when I think it's necessary, and it's usually very impressive.
Jim Gallipo, thank you so much for talking with us.
Okay.
Jim Gallipo is a probation officer with the Los Angeles County Metropolitan Specialized Gang Unit. Our interview was recorded last March. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. We'll have the latest on the American Airlines strike today. Also, a talk with one American flight attendant about why she is striking. We'll hear about President Clinton's appearance in Seattle at the APEC, that's the Asian Pacific Summit, and what he had to say about U.S. trade policy in the future. Also, Morton Halperin, President Clinton's nominee for one of the second-tier positions at Defense, a very controversial nominee, appeared on Capitol Hill today for confirmation hearings. We'll hear about that. And Noah Adams talks with Jonas Fjell, who is a Norwegian singer-songwriter.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Two years ago, the Seattle-based band Nirvana created an anthem for slackers, Smells Like Teen Spirit. The song's popularity not only made the band a superstar act, but also gave rise to a whole school of rock music, grunge, a genre that also includes bands like Pearl Jam, The Melvins, and Tad. Nirvana's charismatically moody lead singer and guitarist, Kurt Cobain, remains the most prominent figure in this movement. Nirvana has finally released a new album, In Utero. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
Yes, I'm relieving, now that you're leaving, soon as you can pay. Yes, I'm relaxing, hear that you're asking, let me get you. Yes, I'm soothing, now that you're soothing.
There have been great misanthropes in rock and roll at least as far back as Bob Dylan, but few have despised the idiocies of their fellow humans with as much focused intensity as Kurt Cobain. The convincing thing about Cobain is that he didn't wait until Nirvana's 1991 album Nevermind sold 4.5 million copies and turned Seattle into the hottest rock scene since Liverpool to heap vitriol upon his audience. No, Cobain was roiling with discontent when Nirvana was little more than a hardcore cult band. It's just that on the group's new album, his malaise is more finely honed.
Same.
teenage angst has paid off well. Now I'm old and bored, the 20-something Cobain sings on that song, Serve the Servants. What turns Cobain's sarcasm away from mere petulance, from moving his listeners to lower the volume and mutter, what's he got to complain about, is the sheer enthusiasm of his orneriness. Well, that and the fact that I think Cobain has one of the great non-voices in rock. I'd rather listen to him shred his vocal cords over the great raging squall of this music than hear most other rockers follow their more mannerly melodies. There's a range to the unhappiness that fills In Utero, from Cobain's anguished sympathy with a young woman attempting to abort her child in the song Pennyroyal Tea, to his attempt to draw his fans' attention to the victims of the war in Bosnia on a song called Rape Me.
Rape me. Rape me, my friend. Rape me. Rape me.
Cobain can be a self-indulgent brat, but he's a thoughtful version of that rock star cliché. Unlike all the other bands lumped together under the corny tag of grunge, Nirvana expresses its post-adolescent, all-purpose anger with the precision of pop artists. Like all great rock misanthropes, they trash the past while building something impressive for a new generation to hold in spirited contempt.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Nancy Greenlease and Peter Clowney. Research assistants from Louisa Shafia. Abby Fanta and Devin Reef are our interns. Fresh Air's theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, exiled South African poet and painter Brighton Breitenbach. He's considered the greatest poet writing in the Afrikaans language. He spent 7 years in prison in South Africa, convicted of terrorism for his anti-apartheid activities. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.